after Robert's delivery, so very stimulating. Very. Now, look, my talk today, this evening, this afternoon, is should the scientist be a provisional atheist? It's rather a strange topic, but put more technically, is methodological naturalism a satisfactory framework for the conduct of science, and especially the science of life? Can you hear me? Is this going? Basically, questions we could pose in this kind of framework are the laws of nature that science has revealed sufficient to account for the phenomenon of life and its evolutionary unfolding? I don't know what happens. In brief, given the explanatory power of modern science, is God talk unnecessary? Or perhaps even admitting that God might have set up things nicely at the beginning and perhaps pressed the ignition button, has life unfolded entirely as a consequence of these initial conditions in accordance with natural processes? Now, it's a common assumption of our secular society that science alone gives us a proper and true understanding of reality. Religious belief might well provide a comforting, subjective prop for one's particular worldview, but it is science alone that delivers the brute facts of our existence. So should proper science then proceed on the assumption of provisional atheism? Should not science proceed unfettered by the ultimately subjective claims of religious belief? But I suggest we can pose some related questions, and these might be, could acknowledgement of an essential transcendent dimension make better sense of the world through the eyes of science? Or put more provocatively, might recognition of a transcendent mindful dimension rescue science from the temptation to deliver explanatory absurdities? Now, Michael Ruse, in his book Darwinism Defended, contrasts the claims of creationists who believe that the origin of the world was miraculous with those of science which deals only with the natural, the repeatable, that which is governed by law, and thus miracles lie outside the realm of science, which I'm sure they do. Thus, in Ruse's view, all of science is the property of being natural or, that is, non-supernatural. So in keeping with the primary theme of this conference, I would like to examine whether life's evolutionary unfolding is really as natural as the materialists would claim it to be. Now, contemporary evolutionary theory asserts that fitness and function of biology arise from the vagaries of natural selection. The avoidance of extinction is all that is sought, and in this view, the idea of evolving towards something is dismissed as illegitimate. Any appearances of design are just that, appearances only, for the entire process is undirected and without purpose, except, of course, the avoidance of extinction, which, of course, poses some problems. Now, my first overhead is, it's a different colour. Philosopher of biology David Papineau has an entry in the Oxford Companion to Philosophy which reads, as you see there, most contemporary philosophers of biology now hold that functional explanations of biology are disguised causal explanations, which explain biological traits not by looking forward but by looking backwards to the past evolutionary histories in which such results led to the natural selection of the traits in question. So we take the example of the polar bear. The functional explanation for its whiteness is not to secure the future camouflaging of bears. Rather, past camouflaging arising from a chance mutation has led to the natural selection of their whiteness. In other words, there was no sense in which the goal of whiteness was ever aimed for. It just so happened that in the Arctic environment, the chance production of whiteness was advantageous to the animal's survival and thus breeding ability. It was thus naturally selected. But I suspect there is a barely hidden problem with this so-called natural mechanism, for it surely implies a teleology of sorts, a teleology of survival, or if you like, a life force manifested by the living organism going to quite remarkable lengths to secure its future. The modern Darwinist, by using such language as advantageous to its survival, is, in my view, admitting to a principle that lies above and beyond those natural laws framed in the language of biological materialism. The living organism, whether a polar bear or an amoeba, is possessed of a strange will to live, and it seems to me, at least, pointless to deny this rather obvious fact of life. If I press that, I don't think it works. Here it is. Where am I? Eric Tomlin, in his fascinating philosophical explorations of the concept of life, points out that the living organism is goal-orientated. It initiates novelty. It seeks to realize its full potential. It is able to take measures against the future in a manner entirely denied to an object. It can provide for the future by reproduction and by repair following injury, while all the time engaging in self-maintenance in the midst of an ever-changing and often hostile external environment. Now, I would personally describe this behavior of a living organism as vitalism, and without any sense of scientific embarrassment. But so intense is the scorn that materialists heap on this concept that it seems appropriate here to make a slight digression. Now, Gareth Hardin, in his primer, Biology, Its Principles and Implications, had this to say of the fundamental divide that has existed historically within biology. He says this: it is the belief of most professional biologists that every activity of a living organism is the result of understandable physical and chemical processes. This statement gives in a nutshell the attitude of the mechanists, the people who believe that all living phenomena have a mechanistic explanation. But he goes on to say, some people think that there are aspects of the activities of living organisms which can never be explained in terms of physics and chemistry, and that to explain these aspects we must invoke a mysterious force which has been called an entelechy or an elan vital. It is such a vital force that permits a living organism to do these marvelous things that living organisms can do and which no physical, chemical machine of man's devising can come near to doing. Those who maintain this position are called vitalists. So there's the two divisions. Now, against his implied support for the mechanist position, Hardin largely dismisses vitalism as sterile. He recalls the comments of Julian Huxley, who had earlier pointed out that in claiming an amoeba is moved by its elan vital is rather like saying that a locomotive is moved by its elan locomotive, and adds that we would not permit an engineer to get away with the latter explanation. Why should we permit a biologist to get away with the former? But such an argument against vitalism, based on the analogy between an amoeba and a locomotive, seems somewhat suspect. A locomotive is certainly not alive in the sense that an amoeba is. This we would all agree. But equally, a locomotive is not explained by mechanism alone, for if we are to use Hardin's definition of mechanism, which is that its activity is explicable entirely in terms of physical and chemical processes. Such processes are certainly harnessed in both the construction of the locomotive and in its activity as a motive power machine. But its very existence and responsive function are foremost a product of considerable engineering ingenuity and locomotive driver skill. Without these crucial non-material personal ingredients, we would have nothing but cold, lifeless hunks of metal. Our locomotive is vitally dependent for its very existence and purposeful activity on its elan persona, the liveness of persons. The wrong way. There is, however, another strand of evolutionary thought that remains rooted in the main elements of Darwinism, but which also acknowledges its explanatory inadequacies. The distinguished British zoologist Alistair Hardy, in his book The Living Stream, offers the reader a glimpse of both his Darwinian orthodoxy, but also his recognition of the need for a non-material or transcendent dimension. Hardy raises a number of important ideas that would seem to strike at the heart of an all-sufficient biological materialism. Firstly, Hardy expresses his own doubts about natural selection and the gene complex being the only factors in evolution. Secondly, he seeks to revive the role of what he refers to as organic selection in evolution. The former emphasizes the selection of the animal by the environment, but in the latter, there is a much more creative interaction between the animal and its environment. Hardy suggests that organic selection is possibly of equal or even greater importance than natural selection. He dismisses as entirely unsupported by the facts of biology the inheritance of acquired characteristics, the almost universally discredited theory proposed originally by Lamarck. But Hardy is also concerned to show that history has not dealt fairly with what he considers was Lamarck's most important contribution to evolutionary thinking, that changes in the environment can bring about changes in the habits of animals, and it is these changes in habit that can be so important in bringing about evolutionary modification, but not in the way that Lamarck originally envisaged. Hardy thus revives what he views as a crucial aspect of evolutionary theory, one hinted at by Lamarck, but developed formally nearly a century later by biologists Osborne, Baldwin, and Morgan. It was the idea that behavioral modifications arising from the animal's natural plasticity, and when repeated for several generations, may hold that particular modification in an environment where mutations tend to the same direction will be selected and incorporated in the organism's genetic makeup. Here I quote Hardy's own summary description of this process. If a population of animals should change their habits, then sooner or later, variations in the gene complex will turn up in the population to produce small alterations in the animal's structure, which will make them more efficient in relation to their new behavioral pattern. These more efficient individuals will tend to survive rather than the less efficient, and so the composition of the population will gradually change. This evolutionary change is one caused initially by a change in behavior. Now, Hardy goes on to emphasize the crucial connection between the emergence of a new habit, what he refers to as the restless, exploring, and perceiving animal that discovers new ways of living and new sources of food. He argues that the living animal should be regarded as an essentially perceiving organism, that this concept of perception carries with it an actively organizing, possibly a purposive element, and that perception is a basic characteristic of the drive of a living animal. Hardy refers to the behavior of some of the simplest animals, the amoeba, literally the changeful one, belonging to a class of simple protozoan animals known as the rhizopoda, implying a root-like foot shape. Although often crudely pictured as a blob of living protoplasm, the amoeba is vastly more fascinating and instructive in its behavior than is implied by this description. In appearance, the animal consists of a granule-laden fluid, the endoplasm, enclosed by a bag-like skin called the plasma membrane. And just inside this membrane is a clear jelly-like layer termed the ectoplasm. Movement begins by a particular point on the jellied ectoplasm liquefying. This altered property allows the more fluid and granular endoplasm to flow forward through the weakened region and thus extend as a foot. By a series of carefully sequenced changes from the jelly, liquid to jelly to liquid state, combined with an appropriate contraction of the outer layer, the animal achieves locomotion and relates more generally to its ever-changing environment. It also uses the same kind of activity to flow round and capture its prey. Now, the amoeba is, of course, exploiting a well-known chemical mechanism as it switches from jelly to liquid. Very appropriately, it's a strange effect, isn't it? Is this the Gates? It's a pity, though. Looks pretty good on here. Anyway, we'll just keep going. Very approximately, the gel state is produced. Oh, that is beautiful. Sorry, I hadn't realized that. Look, let's ignore the screen. Let's just keep going. Very approximately, this gel state is produced by lots of individual molecular chains or polymers becoming interconnected at many points along their length to form an interlocked meshwork extending in all directions, something akin to a three-dimensional onion bag, string onion bag. The other important feature of a gel is that the special chemical properties of the polymer chains endow them with a great love of water. And this floods in and expands the interconnected meshwork to its limit. And this is what gives the jelly its wobbly rigidity. Undo those connections and the whole system reverts to the flowing liquid state. Now all this is relatively straightforward chemistry, but more to the point, the amoeba has the ability to exploit this chemistry for purposes that cannot be framed in the language of chemistry. Yes, amoeboid locomotion is achieved by the chemically derived gel to liquid to gel transformation. However, this chemistry is merely servant to the amoeba's purposeful intentions, namely to shrink from an unfavorable chemical environment or from light, or there it is, or to envelop and digest a food particle. Thanks very much. Well, they all, right till now, have we not had quality visuals? Really? And it's been a massive distraction, hasn't it? Okay, I'm going to move on to the next one, which is amoeboid cannibalism. It can even hunt down its own kind, as shown in the set of images beautifully sketched much earlier by the American biologist Herbert Jennings. In the old days, people sketched what they saw under the microscope, and that's the kind of science we got. Lovely stuff there, beautifully studied, over many hours, no doubt. Now, here's my own attempt to photograph an amoeba caught in the Auckland Domain Pond, and you can see there it's in a relatively composed, relaxed state on the left-hand side. Here I just applied a filter paper to one side of the slide, creating a flow of current, which the amoeba felt frightened of and kind of reached out to claim stability. This lowly creature of the stagnant, watery world is no mere blob of primordial protoplasm. Life, even amoebic life, transcends the laws of chemistry. Now, related to the amoeba are the marine-dwelling foraminifera, forams, I think they call them for short. Many of these animals produce tiny, beautifully geometric shells or tests, which on the animal's death settle to the seabed and form a calcareous ooze. In the fullness of geological time, these shelly remnants of life become cemented into limestone. The White Cliffs of Dover are perhaps the best known examples of the secreted ooze. Other impressive examples are the pyramids of Egypt and the rocky substrate of Paris, from which we make plaster of Paris. Now, producing a well-defined shell from its often striking geometric form is no mean constructional feat for any organism, though such familiar objects usually evoke little curiosity on our part. However, other foraminifera, really do present us with some quite unexpected surprises. They actually construct their own little shelters or shells from the raw ingredients of discarded sponge spicules and other foreign particles such as sand and grit, and with a freedom of architectural design that Alistair Hardy argues is highly suggestive. And this is what he says. If you can read that, this is what he says about this animal's building abilities. To my mind, these various astrorhizid foraminifera present one of the greatest challenges to the exponents of a purely mechanistic view of life. Here are minute animals, apparently as simple in nature as amoeba, without definite sense organs such as eyes, and appearing as mere flowing masses of protoplasm, yet endowed with extraordinary powers. Not only do they select and pick up one type of object from all the jumble of fragments of other sorts on the seabed, but they build them into a design involving a comparison of size. They build as if to a plan. And there must be an instinct of how to build and some sort of memory as how far they have filled in the spaces and what sizes of spicules remain to be picked up to complete the section. Now remember that Alistair Hardy declared himself to be in most respects an orthodox Darwinist. He is not doubting that random mutations of the gene and their recombinations acted on by natural selection is a creative force in evolution. He is, however, calling for a recognition of additional factors that clearly point away from the entrenched physicalism and materialism that has so dominated modern evolutionary biology. In calling for a renewed recognition of the importance of behavior and habit as an internal selective force in evolution, Hardy sees the operation of an actual, not apparent, purposeful drive in the living organism. In addressing the issue of the origin of homologous structures, for example, the equivalent bones in the forelimbs of humans, whales, birds, and bats, and especially the remarkable stability of such structures within a species, Hardy questions whether the conventional Darwinian explanation of selection by the environment, and especially with its large degree of heterogeneity, is really sufficient. According to modern mechanistic biology, he says, the only plan for the intricate homologous machinery, for instance, the vertebrate, the arthropod, or the molluscan plan, would seem to have been laid down by the variable environment outside. He says, I am perfectly prepared to accept the proposition that the genetic code is handing on from generation to generation the specification for the plan of development of the animal's body as determined by an act of selection of one sort or another. I am doubting, however, whether the plan itself is entirely the product of the environment. To my way of thinking and remembering the great variety of environments which a single species may encounter and the variety of different kinds of animals that may live in that same habitat, such a conclusion seems almost a reductio ad absurdum. Hardy refers to another biological problem which he again argues is not easily accounted for by a changing environment. It is the fascinating concept developed by Darcy Thompson in his book on growth and form. Hardy readily accepts that biology has demonstrated the reality of growth inhibiting and or promoting factors that diffuse through the tissues and influence their growth. However, it is the beautifully coordinated, beautifully mathematically proportioned plan of growth, as illustrated by Darcy Thompson's transformations, that he argues is not easily explained by the selective influence of a very heterogeneous environment. Hardy develops the idea that it might be a general subconscious sharing of a form and behavior pattern or habit between members of a species. He suggests there are two parallel streams of information. The DNA supplying the varying physical form of the organic stream, which is acted on by natural selection, the other being the shared subconscious species behavioral pan of life. That is the species design or blueprint. This species plan of life would act as an internal selecting standard in which those that did not meet it would tend to be eliminated by natural selection. And importantly, Hardy suggests that all this has the appearance of a definite mental conception or design pattern that is outside the physical world and which serves as a template or gauge for selective action. There is, in Hardy's view, too much of mind in the living world to call it mindless. And he calls for a... I've gone too far on that one. I won't, I'll leave it there. He calls for a truer biology, one that will not sell its soul to physics and chemistry for quick results, but will emerge and tackle the more important and more difficult aspects of life about which whose nature we are almost as ignorant as when physics and chemistry began. He says, I say more important because in this field lie consciousness, the nature of memory, the feeling of purpose, love, joy, and sorrow, the sense of the sacred, the sense of right and wrong, the appreciation of beauty, indeed all the things that really matter in life. However, I would like to add that even with Alistair Hardy's appeal to a transcendent dimension, major questions remain as to how such a mind dimension, might interact with the purely material. It is one thing to argue that the frog egg might be developing in resonance with a tadpole idea, but how matter is added step by step, molecule by molecule, cell by cell, in an appropriate way to produce such a complex living system remains beyond the reach of our current science. One thing seems certain. More satisfactory theories of life must surely evolve in mindful rather than mindless directions. We can, of course, draw a parallel with any engineering device and ask how the atoms are added atom by atom to create the shape of a crankshaft, a spark plug, or a knife and fork. I'll leave that for you to answer. Let me now turn briefly to the work of the Canadian biologist Brian Goodwin, previously at Surrey University and now a professor of biology at the Schumacher College in Devon. That would be Schumacher of Small is Beautiful. In 82, he wrote an article in the science journal Biologist entitled Biology Without Darwinian Spectacles. And in this he argued that Darwin turned biology into what he calls an historical science. Goodwin. Goodwin's basic argument, and one developed more thoroughly in his 1994 book, How the Leopard Changed Its Spots, is that in Darwinism, species are simply accidents of history arising from the shuffling of the genetic package, from interactions between individuals competing for scarce resources, and natural selection which prunes out the weak and maladapted. So in Darwinism, species don't have any inherent value, or any inherent nature, shall I say. They are just the way things happen to work out, and there aren't any particular constraints on species. In the persuasive spirit of the late Stephen Gould, rerun the evolutionary video and a completely different biology would result. Now, Goodwin argues that this historic approach to biology became powerfully reinforced with the triumph of genetics and molecular biology. From this, we have learned how a particular biopolymer called DNA makes copies of itself, how particular DNA sequences give rise to particular macromolecules or proteins, and how organisms inherit the ability to make specific types of molecules. Then there is only a small step to the belief that organisms can be exhaustively described and understood in terms of their molecular composition. That is, they are fully accounted for in terms of what types of molecules are made in the life history of the organism. And since all of the information for this molecule making is written in the genes, it is widely accepted that organisms are determined by genetic programs, which are the historic records of successive adaptation to the species due ultimately to specific molecules. Further, because there are no intrinsic constraints on the instructional content within this genetic program, there are no constraints on the molecular compositions that can be specified, and thus no constraints on possible morphologies. This, Goodwin argues, is the freedom allowed for within these so-called historical explanations in biology. The historical approach sees all of biological life as a series of fortuitous happenings. Transformation is entirely a result of history and particular events, that is either chance, heritable variations in the organism, or random changes in the external environment. There is no rational, logical principle of transformation, merely what Goodwin refers to as a domain of contingencies, or events that are perpetuated because they just happen to confer on an organism an adaptive advantage in the environment in which they just happen to find themselves. Thus, if we ask, why do humans have five digits in their hands and feet? The answer is because the common ancestor of the land-dwelling vertebrates happened to have five digits in its limb, and this pattern has been conserved. To then account for the fact that in other vertebrates this number is not conserved, birds have three, antelopes two, and horses one, an additional historical or contingent factor is added, natural selection. Thus, under the conditions under which horses evolved, on relatively flat grassland, This favored the development of a single elongated digit in the limbs, which conferred the ability to run faster and escape predators. This style of explanation is due largely to Charles Darwin. But Goodwin alerts us to the difficulties of this historical approach. The fundamental problem is that contemporary Darwinism reduces the organism to its genes and their products. The organism as a whole is sacrificed to this reductionist framework in which the gene reigns supreme. Thus, knowledge of the gene is considered sufficient to explain an organism's development and the emergence of a species with its characteristic form and behavior. The problem, Goodwin points out, is that we actually need to know much more, and it is simply not true that knowledge of an organism's genetic makeup is sufficient to predict its form. The gene on its own is biologically helpless. It needs its rich cellular context. As a crude analogy, and it's too crude for most of us here, I assume. If we think the genome as providing a set of recipes for making the various protein building blocks of life, then it should be obvious that the final arrangement of these bricks lies beyond and above what the genome recipes provide. The architect builder conceives the mansion, the brick certainly does not. However, it is also true that a single error in a gene can have dramatic consequences. For example, the fruit fly can have a mutation that transforms a two-winger into a four-winger. This, the modern Darwinist will argue, is the feedstock of evolutionary transformation. And while the Darwinist couches his or her explanations in terms of a genetic program, if you ask him to use this to generate an organism, he cannot deliver. And the reason is simple. You need to know much more than what the gene produces in order to explain the emergence of morphology. So Goodwin, in his approach to explaining the evolution of biological form, asked the obvious question, how do we describe biological form? Now in physics, in order to describe a specific arrangement of matter and energy, something called a field equation is required. Schrödinger's wave equation, for example, describes the behavior of electrons in the attractive field of the nucleus, thus defining the space-time form of the electron cloud and its role in determining bonding direction between atoms. Goodwin illustrates this concept of a field further using the analogy of water flowing out of the bath. It will run out either in a left-hand or right-hand spot, unless, of course, you leave the bath water for 3 days, then you might get the preferred direction, Coriolis direction. However, I did the experiment the other night, you can certainly change the direction very easily. The water movement you generate with your hand will determine the left or right-handedness of the spiral, and it is easy to transform from one direction to the other. Try it tonight. While the hand produces particular conditions for either direction, it is the property of the liquid state as described, not explained, as described by the Navier-Stokes equation that gives the spiral motion. My hand produces particular conditions which select or stabilize one or other of these field solutions. It is not my hand that produces these. In the same way, genes may contribute to or influence the selection of particular solutions, but they do not generate form. Goodwin is arguing for the recognition of principles of organization or laws of form in biology. The realization that genes do not generate biological form leads to a very different view of the evolutionary process in terms of the potential forms of organisms and their appearance on the Earth. In Goodwin's view, understanding organisms as fields of potential or possibilities alters drastically the nature of freedom and determinism in the biological realm, and directs us away from the view that organisms are the result of a kind of coded existential history written in their genes. In effect, Goodwin is arguing that these fields of potential guide and constrain biological form or development, thus limiting the variety of forms that can be generated, hence the generation of distinct species. Goodwin therefore sees biological development in terms of universal generative fields, fundamental laws of biological form, and macromolecular particulars, the gene, that contribute to the selection of particular field solutions. Yet Goodwin is quite hard to pin down as to what he really means. He is implacably opposed to reductionist science and thus argues strongly for a new science of qualities. But what does he mean by this? My own reading of Goodwin so far suggests that he is at heart a materialist, seeking for yet more material laws to explain the materially inexplicable. But I could be wrong. Now, just one final little point to make, which is just not too long. Also antagonistic to the accidents of history view of modern evolutionary theory is Cambridge paleobiologist Simon Conway Morris. In his book Life's Solution, Conway Morris goes to considerable lengths to show that evolution is not nearly as accidental as the ultra-Darwinists would have us believe. Rather, out of a vast horizon of possibilities, evolution converges on a surprisingly limited number of selective destinations. Conway Morris argues that this convergence reflects a much deeper structure to biology, in essence a creation, and a concept the hardcore Darwinist will oppose to the bitter end. And some of the characteristics of evolution that Conway Morris suggests are congruent with a creation are first are first that despite the combinatorial immensities of biological hyperspace, as he calls it, evolution has a way of navigating to that minutest of fractions which actually work. Secondly, he reminds us of the extreme sensitivity of the evolutionary process, whereby nearly all alternatives are disastrously maladaptive. Recall the example of the fruit fly wing. A single error in a gene can result in a four wing rather than a two wing. A warning here surely against gene tampering. Then there is the inherency of life, whereby complexity emerges as much by the rearrangement and co-opting of existing building blocks as against relying on novelty per se. Lastly, Conway Morris emphasizes the exuberance of biological diversity, but the ubiquity of evolutionary convergence. He describes, for example, the derivation of the grasping raptorial forelimb of the praying mantis and the mantis bar, both only distant related within the insectic class. The other one he gives many examples. The arrival of the camera eye solution from very different animal lines, the vertebrates, some mollusk groups, for example, the squid and octopus, and a much less well-known species of marine annelid worm. Conway Morris, basically his book abounds in some wonderful illustrations, examples of this remarkable common solution that the evolutionary radar has found. So there is something about life, about the amoeba, about humans, that cries out for a deeper, more purpose-laden explanation. The signposts of religion, and specifically Christian theism, would seem to provide a much more satisfactory resolution of the issues that naturalistic science has striven to explain away. Michael Polanyi, commenting on the religious truth of Scripture in his book, Personal Knowledge, has this to say. The book of Genesis and its great pictorial illustrations like the frescoes of Michelangelo remain a far more intelligent account of the nature and origin of the universe than the representation of the world as a chance collocation of atoms. For the biblical cosmology continues to express, however inadequately, the significance of the fact that the world exists and that man has emerged from it, while the scientific picture denies any meaning to the world. The assumption that the world has some meaning, which is linked to our own calling as the only morally responsible beings in the world, is an important example of the supernatural aspect of experience, which Christian interpretations of the universe explore and develop. So I leave you with this thought. If this world is ultimately a consequence of a great idea, then any attempt to interpret and make sense of this world while denying this great idea will surely tell in an adequate story. Thank you. Time for one question, apparently. It seems to me that more science finds out, the more it seems to expose this wonderful dimension upon which science fits. It doesn't. I think it reinforces the transcendence rather than kind of exposes gaps. One question.
That's a very good question, so perhaps one more. Was the work of Rupert Sheldrake sort of linked in with this?
I think Hardy and Sheldrake would probably sleep in the parallel beds. And Robert is, of course, our Sheldrake expert. You might want to... I think, in a sense, they're all pleas for a recognition that our hardcore physicalism that science really clings to is is really inadequate. And these are all kind of pictures of our cry for something that reaches beyond that kind of physical, chemical picture that we're so obsessed with in our science. So,
I think God of the gaps is an inaccurate, pejorative term. If there are things which science does not explain, you can easily sling God of the gaps, and that stops you having to have any philosophy or explanation which copes with those things. It's not quite fair to say that it's a God of the gaps.
Better wrap it up. Would you please thank Neil for